Which state will bring an expected challenge to Roe versus Wade? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, why the battle over abortion is flaring up again here in Florida. You can give us a call with your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Then later, working to reduce food insecurity here on the First Coast. All of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, pro-choice activists are marching this weekend in St. Augustine. The St. Augustine March for Choice is happening as laws restricting or virtually banning abortion have been enacted in a number of states around the country, but not here in Florida. Abortion is legal in this state, although two attempts to pass what are known as fetal heartbeat bills were introduced last year in Tallahassee. In a few moments, we'll speak with the North Florida director of Florida Right to Life. First, we welcome Layla Slate. She's the organizer of the St. Augustine March for Choice, and she joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So you've organized a March for Choice this weekend in St. Augustine, going from Anastasia Island across the Bridge of Lions to the downtown plaza. Why this weekend? What's happening?
We chose right now because a few interns and I are working this summer on a couple goals that we're really interested in. One of those that we picked out was reproductive justice, specifically because in Florida right now, there has been a move towards introducing fetal heartbeat bills and generally more of a lean in the South towards introducing those bills.
A number of states have virtually banned abortion. The closest to Florida is Alabama. Here in Florida, abortion is legal, although there are fewer abortion clinics in this state than there used to be. And as you said, there were a couple of attempts in the last legislative session to get a fetal heartbeat bill to the governor's desk.
Yes.
It did not make its way to Governor DeSantis's desk, although he has said he would sign such a bill if it did make its way through the legislative process.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, a fetal heartbeat bill would ban abortion after six to eight weeks of pregnancy when a fetal heartbeat is detected. Why do you oppose that?
Well, for most women, they don't even know they're pregnant by that point. So essentially, legislation like this would pretty much be effectively an outright ban because most women aren't even aware in the first place that they're already pregnant.
56% of adults said in a recent poll by the Pew Research Center that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. That said, this is certainly a divisive, deeply felt issue for people in this country. And so you're pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to listeners out there who are pro-life and they're morally opposed to abortion?
I think the individual moral difference, that's completely valid. If you are against having an abortion procedure done, then you simply just don't have to have one. I don't think there's any woman out there who wants to go through with an abortion. But the fact of the matter is that situation in life, economic disparity, inequality, circumstance, all of these things are a driving force behind why one in four women today have had an abortion. So limiting the access to that isn't going to make it disappear. It's just going to make it unsafe for women, risking women's health, when there's already a disparity between taking care of yourself and having access to contraceptives, reproductive health care, all of the things that make it much more feasible to have and raise a child in this country. So I think that these laws really don't do anything to stop abortion from happening. It's not getting at the root source of why women are pursuing this and feeling like it's their only option. All it's really doing is making it less safely accessible.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Florida has not really gone there yet when it comes to abortion.
Yeah.
A number of other states have, though. The hashtag Stop the Bans began trending when Alabama in particular virtually outlawed abortion in that state.
Mm-hmm.
It's widely expected that a challenge to Roe versus Wade will come before the Supreme Court at some point soon.
Yeah.
And so as this makes its way through the legal process, there's also the political process, in the sense that political pundits that have watched this in Florida have observed or opined that the legislature hasn't aggressively moved to limit abortion in Florida, given that this is a swing state.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's important to both parties in 2020. What are your thoughts about that?
I think there's a big, that representatives have had a large awareness that it may alienate certain voters and therefore kind of risk their position. But I think if you're at the point where it is so divisive, you may lose voters if this issue, if let's say the fetal heartbeat bill did pass and you'd have voters turn the other way because of that. I think if you are risking alienating people, then you're not really truly representing what they want. You know, it is extremely divisive, and it's something that I think if we went a different way with addressing how to get to the source of the problem, maybe with access to universal reproductive health care, we have major wealth gap in this country that's kind of widening, that makes it more difficult to raise children and be sustainable. So if there were, and, you know, we don't even provide universal sex ed. So, and we don't have access to affordable contraceptives. So these are things that you could go towards that would limit, I think, the amount of women that want to turn towards abortion. Those are more realistic solutions versus just simply outlawing it and saying that, you know, you may just have to turn towards illegal abortions, because that is what will mostly happen.
Now, as we mentioned, abortion is still legal in Florida. Pro-life activists in the state have been working for years, though, to change that. They did bring several bills forward in the last legislative session. Those measures did not make their way into law. However, Governor Ron DeSantis says if a fetal heartbeat bill makes its way to his desk next year, he will sign it. When does a fetus become viable? How do you define personhood? These are deep questions that drive this debate. And we spoke about it yesterday with Teresa Graham, president of North Florida Right to Life. Let's listen. Teresa Graham, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Appreciate your time. And as we talk about this issue, of course, all eyes are on Florida. Some states are restricting access to abortion. Others are increasing access. And the debate is heating up here in Florida. Legislators introduced at least four bills this year that would restrict abortion in the Sunshine State, although none of them passed. What is the role of Right to Life in this state, particularly North Florida Right to Life? What efforts are you undertaking right now to move Florida in the direction you want it to go on the abortion issue?
Well, North Florida Right to Life, as we stand, we stay education-based as well as legislative-based. So we're educating women on pro-life. So our stand mainly is for the life of the child, the life of the baby. We're seeing a lot of disturbing birth abortion type methods coming forth.
What do you mean?
Such as you know, you've got methotrexate and misoprostol. You know, you've got these pills. One of them labeled as RU486, for example. You know, we've got, you know, college young ladies taking these pills, walking out the door. Basically, they're having abortions in their on the toilet in their dorms. You know, this is a scary thing out there. They're sending these women out the door with these abortion pills. They're not even doing abortions in the clinics anymore. They're sending these women out the door to have an abortion at home. You can order some of these pills online. You don't even
right.
know what you're
and,
getting your hands
on. And so it's your position that would... Is your goal to see a total or a near total abortion ban in Florida? For example, Governor DeSantis has said he would sign what are called a fetal heartbeat bill if it landed on his desk. In other words, banning abortion after 6 to 8 weeks of pregnancy. That hasn't gotten a hearing in the legislature, but it could. Do you support that kind of legislation?
I do, because the heartbeat is detected. That's the life of a baby. That's a heartbeat is detected. That's a live baby.
And certainly this issue is so deeply felt on both sides. People on the pro-life side make the argument that once a heartbeat is detected, human life is present. What would you say to those listening who fall more on the other side? They feel that the woman's right to reproductive control is more important. What's your response to that argument?
Well, my response to that argument, especially on an educational side, is abortion is not birth control. There are other things that you can do to prevent pregnancy. Try to go there first. That's part of the education process, is prevent the pregnancy. Abortion is not birth control. When you've got a baby there, that's a baby, and having an abortion is murder and taking the life of that child.
What do you think Florida could do in the way of making access to family planning and women's health, reproductive health and gynecological health, that access more accessible, so that there would be, fewer unwanted pregnancies?
And I think that, Florida as a state and even Planned Parenthood is going to offer some of those things. Your women gynecologists are offering preventative. There's birth control. There's all types of methods that you can do to prevent pregnancy. There's the rhythm method for the natural planning for the one who doesn't want to take medication and be on any type of medication to prevent pregnancy.
But the rhythm method doesn't work, really, does it? The rhythm method doesn't work well, does it? I mean, wouldn't you prefer the birth control pill or some other kind of contraception?
Well, those are all available. That's what I'm saying. Uh-huh. Whatever method you choose, there's many methods.
And that's Teresa Graham. She's president of North Florida Right to Life. And now, a bit of history. Attempts to overturn Roe v. Wade are nothing new. In fact, they began almost as soon as the Supreme Court legalized abortion in 1973. In 1975, Mary Marcus was a triage nurse in Boston. She attended the first major trial aimed at overturning Roe v. Wade. A doctor named Kenneth Edelin was found guilty of manslaughter by a Boston jury in February 1975 in the alleged death of a fetus following an abortion. The discussion of when a baby is viable outside the womb was a big part of that trial. Edelin's conviction was later overturned. Marcus lives in this area now and shared her recollections with us. Let's listen.
This was in Boston, and I had just founded the triage, nurse triage at Mass General Hospital in the emergency room. And I had heard through volunteering at the United Way that there was going to be a trial involving a doctor at Boston City Hospital. And it had to do with abortion. So it sounded like an important trial, so I hoofed it over there. The doctor involved was black, and he was one of the first black physicians who was department chair for obstetrics and gynecology. What they said, there was a physician who testified against him, that in the delivery room, he was delivering a fetus as part of an abortion, and he held the fetus's head up against the womb while watching the delivery room clock, supposedly smothering a viable baby. There wasn't even a clock in the delivery room. It had been sent out for repairs. And subsequent people testifying that were in the delivery room said the same thing. It was 9 months after Roe v. Wade. The outcome of the trial was the doctor was convicted of manslaughter. He got no jail time. He did not lose his license. And within a year, it was overturned. There was basically no evidence, but there was a lot of strong, as there is today, a lot of strong feeling about abortion, and they had been looking for a case. It was the phrase of, doctors are killing babies, I heard that, and I heard that prohibition of abortion was hearing a heartbeat. And in the course of the trial, and there's articles, there's plays, et cetera, about this particular trial, they brought up about how do you judge when a baby is viable. Now, this is 1975, and now so many years later, I'm hearing some of the same phrasing. And this was very big during the Edelin trial that he had killed a baby. The patient herself was 17 years old. Her mother had brought her in. And again, unwed motherhood in the 70s was tough to deal with. The tension in that courtroom was, you could cut it with a knife. I didn't go back. I went that one day, and I was just so shook that you could be doing... I saw myself as a nurse, and I thought, I could be doing my job to the best of my ability, best practice, following policies and procedures of the hospital, and depending on the climate, I could be brought to trial for something that I considered part of my professional practice. I'm really here because I'm very concerned that the fallout from this is going to be limiting healthcare for women. Who uses the healthcare system the most? Women from pre-adolescence to past menopause. And because of our anatomy, we have to go to the doctor frequently, have blood tests, have regular tests, have surgeries, deliver babies. Our care is a huge part of the whole healthcare system. The next thing to go will be other parts of the care. You close a clinic that provides multiple services, everything goes with it. And even if you have good health insurance, you have to wonder whether medical students or nurse practitioners or midwives are going to go into the practice of obstetrics and gynecology when it's so controversial and they're not sure they're going to get paid. So you could have good insurance and have to travel 200 miles to find a doctor who's a specialist in female anatomy. It's not talked about that when you take one piece that's really a small piece of women's health care, a lot of other things go with it.
And so several perspectives we've heard so far on the show today around the issue of abortion as activists plan a march this weekend in St. Augustine. And now your calls. Let's begin with Kathy in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Kathy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was curious about some of the language that's getting used now. I'd heard your first guest refer to reproductive justice, and I do think that both sides are approaching the Roe v. Wade decision as though that were the arbiter of justice. And really, justice happens more in the, you know, the local realm, local politics, local services, things like that. And the Supreme Court simply, what's the term? They provide a negative right. It isn't a right to abortion women have. It is a right to not be criminalized for abortion. So we've had two different cases in the U.S. that have demonstrated that if women were to lose the right to abortion, they would lose a certain amount of autonomy in their abilities to protect their babies, whether they're in the womb or not. One was a woman in Alabama who she had gotten into an argument with somebody, and that person pulled out a gun and shot her in the belly and killed her baby. And the woman carrying the baby was charged with the crime. Because she didn't protect her baby.
And let me ask you, Kathy, there was an outcry over that, wasn't there, resulting in the charges against the woman being dropped? Because there was a social media outcry, correct?
Right. So, again, it was in the local realm where people were looking for justice and not in the political realm. Or, excuse me, in a sense, it could be in the political realm. It could be local politics. But the Supreme Court decision didn't really weigh in on her behalf so much as to say that, you know, she is an independent person. All the Supreme Court decision is going to do is going to choose, well, whose rights come first, the baby or the mother? And if we establish that it's the baby has very little agency to look out for itself. Whereas the mother has a great deal of agency to look out for the baby when she makes those choices. So there was another woman who chose to carry her baby to term after rape, and only after that discovered that the rapist was now applying for parental rights. And if the baby's rights came before the mother, there is the threat that the baby would have a right to her biological father or his biological father. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the woman had enough agency that she could fight for the well-being of her baby. And so if the two sides were approaching this from a reproductive justice point of view, they could be in collaborating on the parts of it that look out for the welfare of both the baby and the mother.
Okay.
Because the Supreme Court can't do that.
Well, Kathy, I thank you for, you're obviously very well informed on the recent cases, especially. So thank you for those comments. Layla Slate, why do you use the term reproductive justice?
Simply because it's more encompassing of the issue at hand. I think that the terms pro-choice and pro-life can be a bit polarizing and a little bit reducing of what the issue is. It does have more to do with protecting and fighting for women's equality, autonomy over themselves, ability to make their own decisions about what it is they feel is best for their own health, their own life, and whether or not they're prepared or even wanting to be mothers at the time, because ultimately, you know, there is no contraceptive that is 100% effective. Unplanned pregnancies are always going to occur.
Roger on the South Side. Hello, Roger. Good morning.
Good morning. All this discussion barely touches on the fact that all this applies only to poor women. Rich women, those who can afford it and want an abortion, will go to Canada or to Europe, any place where it's safe and legal. It's the women who can't afford that have to deal with restrictions on their freedom.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Roger, thank you for that call. And actually, the statistics do bear that out. In this country, the majority of women who do seek abortions are lower income women.
Mm-hmm.
That said, when we heard earlier from the head of North Florida Right to Life,
mm-hmm.
her position is that we should increase access to contraception
mm-hmm.
to all women
yeah.
so that abortion isn't necessary.
Yeah. I mean, she does have a point. I mean, contraceptives are unfortunately extremely expensive, hard to access for a lot of women. And it does make a problem just as much as the fact that we don't have sex education in our public school system. So,
You just graduated from high school.
Yeah, I went to
were you taught about sex education?
So I received my education in the public school system in St. John's County since fifth grade, and I never received any form of sex education. We had a puberty video in fifth grade, and that was about it. And I've known of young girls who have become pregnant at a young age. And I just think it really is incredibly a major failing at this point on our part in this country at this day and age. We could be providing substantial education. We agree that we put our children into school and we vaccinate them first because it's best for their health overall. For all of the students, but yet we don't prepare them with any form of proper sex education to send them out into the world capable of protecting themselves, having safe sex, preventing the spread of STDs, and preventing, you know, early unplanned pregnancies. So when these things happen, how can you blame young people when they were never provided any form of sex education?
Here's a tweet from Brian. Poor rural areas are medically underserved,
yes,
especially when it comes to women's health.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your position on abortion, closing clinics in middle America adds to women's health risks.
Yeah.
That was the position of Mary Marcus, who we heard from a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't take a position on abortion so much as a retired nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Her concern had more to do with the potential of reducing access to women's health,
yeah.
since women's anatomy is such that they take up a big chunk of
yeah.
the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so is that driving your activism?
For sure. I mean, like I mentioned before, with the recent rise in pushing for abortion bans, I think if you're a legislator on the side of, you know, pro-life and you want to reduce the amount of abortions that are occurring, if you truly want that, I think there are solutions that get at the root of the problem, like guaranteeing women's access to reproductive health care and the resources that we need to take care of ourselves and having sex education so our children are prepared to go into the world and having contraceptives available, because even when they are available, pregnancies will still occur. But that's the least you could do in preventing it. And that would be a reasonable solution to reducing the amount who feel that they only have the choice to turn to abortions, because no one realistically wants to have an abortion. It is because of factors of, you know, underserved women in rural areas with lack of resources and, you know, low income. These factors that push women towards feeling like they cannot realistically raise a child the way that they would want to, if they even want to be pregnant in the first place. So these are issues that make it unfortunately, the reality that women feel that that is their only choice. So why don't we turn towards making actual solutions instead of saying, you know what, you can't access safe abortions, but you'll probably end up having to turn towards going towards that solution at home in an unsafe way, because it's not going to, the reality is it doesn't curb the amount of women who will turn to that if that's what they feel is the only option.
Well, we thank you for appearing. Layla Slade of St. Augustine March for Choice will lead a march this Saturday in St. Augustine. We also heard from Teresa Graham, North Florida Right to Life, and retired triage nurse Mary Marcus. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Much more still ahead. Later, how Caddyshack Ranch is going to knock your socks off this weekend in a special event. But up next, meeting the challenge of food insecurity in Florida. We'll be right back.
Front page of today's Times Union.
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers may...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, Radio Reading gives voice to the printed word.
I'm Lindsay Kilbride, host of WJCT's podcast, What It's Like. It starts with some of the best conversations recorded in Jacksonville by StoryCorps.
I remember being on the school bus and passing by and seeing you outside. You were under the addiction at the time.
And then I go deeper into the story.
How do you cope with the guilt you still feel? How do you cope with that?
Subscribe to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
By the time today's babies are 80 years old, the sea is projected to have risen up to 6.6 feet. So what's being done to protect life on the first coast? On ADAPT from WJCT, you'll find stories about adaptation by everyone from the Navy to realtors and the city of Jacksonville. Join us now at adaptflorida.org.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, a North Florida congressman wants to tackle food insecurity on college campuses by allowing more low-income college students to access the Supplemental Food Assistance Program, also known as SNAP benefits. As WJCT's Abhikar Adan reports, Lawson's bill comes as the Trump administration is proposing to downsize the food assistance program.
12 Democrats have signed on to Representative Al Lawson's College Student Hunger Act. Lawson says thousands of students in his own district, which stretches from just west of Tallahassee to Jacksonville, are facing food insecurity.
If you look at Florida State University, there's about 8,000 or 9,000 students out of the 40,000 that need assistance. And the same thing is true as you look across the district.
Some colleges, like Florida State College in Jacksonville, run food pantries. Felicia Bird with FSCJ says students can take up to 5 pounds of food a day at either the South or downtown campus.
They just kept saying, wow, I didn't know that this was here. My mom is going to be so happy to know that this is here.
Lawson says that's great, but the issue should be addressed at the federal level. In addition to expanding SNAP to include students, his bill would require the federal government to notify students of their eligibility and create a pilot program to offset the cost of meals. Abu Karadan, 89.9 WJCT News.
Going beyond the college campus, food insecurity is a huge issue in our area and in this state. Nearly 3 million people in Florida are food insecure. That includes 800,000 kids and 500,000 seniors. Addressing this is not a one-size-fits-all approach either. So, GuideWell is issuing a statewide challenge to entrepreneurs, nonprofits, innovators, and organizations. They're seeking the most innovative ideas for ending food insecurity in their communities. Right now, we're pleased to welcome Susan Toler, Vice President of the Florida Blue Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Kirsty McCool, Executive Director of GuideWell Innovation. Kirsty, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And what are your questions about food insecurity? Give us a call at 549-2937. Susan Toler, let's begin with you. First, let's define food insecurity, because it's a big problem for hundreds of thousands of people in Florida. How do you define food insecurity at Florida Blue Foundation?
Thanks, Melissa. It's really beyond hunger. It's the inability to access sufficient and nutritious foods for your household on a regular basis.
Right. You're not starving to death, but right. You don't always know where your next meal is coming
from. That's right. That's right. So, you know, you can be hungry one day and get some food, but it's this kind of constant, systemic, chronic problem of where your next meal is, and also making sure that you have the right type of nutrition that you need to be healthy and to grow.
Right. So many people live in food deserts. They don't live anywhere near a grocery store with access to fresh produce, for example. So Kirsty McCool, you're executive director at GuideWell Innovation. All of these issues prompted you to design this challenge. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we're very excited about this particular program. So we've issued a statewide challenge, and we're focusing on entrepreneurs, nonprofits, innovators, and other organizations that are, and what we're looking for is the most innovative ideas for ending food security in the local communities. As you mentioned, food security is not a one-size-fits-all issue. So solutions that work in one community in Florida may not work in another. So what we're looking for in particular is hyper-local ideas on how these entities can address food insecurity in their local neighborhoods and communities.
Right. In particular, how to get fresh fruits, vegetables, and healthy whole foods into these food deserts. We have quite a few of those here in Jacksonville. And people have tried patchwork attempts, you know, to try to look at this. Creating little vegetable gardens in their neighborhood, Susan, is one thing that we've seen a lot of.
Right.
But you're looking for an even more comprehensive approach.
Absolutely. For the challenge, it can be those small ideas that can be super innovative and can scale up. But our foundation is working with Feeding Florida on a statewide analysis to look at that system of food, right? Mm-hmm. Because to your point, Melissa, there are wonderful programs being done across both Northeast Florida and the state. But how do they connect together, and how does it create that continuum for food and that sustainable system? Kind of, so you have to look at it at a statewide level, but you start with it kind of block by block, right? Zip code by zip code, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to launch this challenge and called it block by block, because, you know, it starts really at your street, at your neighborhood, and then expands from there.
Kirsty, that's right. People on the ground in their communities are already working on this, and you're looking to increase that, as Susan said, block by block.
That's right. There are four main areas we're looking to address: availability, affordability, and sustainability of food supplies within these insecure communities, improved access to healthy foods like fresh fruits and vegetables within these food deserts. And another important aspect is proper education. Training families and seniors on how to prepare and store healthy foods, proper nutrition, reducing food waste, and things like that. But as Susan mentioned, we're particularly interested in innovative approaches that enable people that live within these food insecure communities to help themselves bootstrap and turn their communities into more food secure neighborhoods. So it could be things like student teams looking to work on community projects within their local communities around creating a more food secure ecosystem. As you pointed out, local religious institutions sometimes grow gardens or provide educational workshops. And then also things like helping people find transportation to food secure areas where they can access healthy grocery stores and things like that. Because in cases, they don't have access to, you know, sources of food within their local communities where they can get access to healthy, affordable food.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the Florida Blue Foundation and GuideWell's Block by Block Food Insecurity Challenge. Here's a tweet from Josh. Food insecurity will never go away unless we address the underlying cause. Wages have not kept up with the cost of expenses like rent, health care, college, etc. SNAP benefits are a sign the free market has failed. Susan Toler, what about that? Real wages have been stagnant, in effect, since the 70s, as the cost of living keeps going up. What about that part of the issue?
Well, you're absolutely right in that none of these issues are in silos. Everything is connected together. And as a health solutions company, we certainly look at the social determinants of health. And food is one of those, education and poverty and income and job opportunities. Those all relate to your health. And when those are not working right and there's gaps mm-hmm. in that, your health suffers. You know, you could not be as healthy and as active as you want to be. So that's part of that Feeding Florida study is to, again, kind of look at the whole picture and have that holistic view and look at those social determinants of health and see how we can do that together. You know, mm-hmm. It's no coincidence that there's a correlation between children under 18 living in poverty and the food deserts, right? So there's definitely a connection.
Kirsty, let me ask you as a follow-up question. As we noted at the start of this segment, the Trump administration wants to tighten the rules governing who qualifies for food stamps or SNAP benefits. That could strip food stamp benefits from about 3 million Americans if the proposal were to be enacted. This news is breaking just as you announced the GuideWell Food Insecurity Challenge. And so what's your response to what's coming out of the White House in terms of how we as a country dole out food stamp benefits?
Yeah, it's a tough issue, as the caller earlier mentioned. So as part of this program here, we're, again, very focused on folks working within their communities to help each other and to connect them into resources at the grassroots level. At the national political scene is not always, in my opinion, anyway, the best source for local and community programs and projects. It tends to be on the city or county level, and those are the places, and whether it be the government entities or the nonprofits or other organizations that I think are best equipped to help folks that are in food insecure situations.
Certainly, though, if at the federal level SNAP benefits are greatly reduced, won't that increase the urgency of a challenge like this one?
Absolutely. So, and this is not going to be solved with just one program. It'll be an ongoing, sustainable effort that needs to be put in place over the course of time. And the work Susan and the foundation are doing are very much focused at the bottom line issue at these local levels.
Let's go to a few calls. Joshua is in San Marco. Hi, Joshua. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. I just wanted to say that I agree with the, I actually caught the end of that little part, but I think it is important to educate people and teach them how to learn or how to grow their own food so they're not dependent on, these other benefits and things like that from the government, and they're also getting way better food than they would be buying stuff at, little corner stores and things like that.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that, Joshua. Can you talk a little bit about that, Susan, how this fits into the challenge, encouraging people, teaching people how to grow their own produce? Is that part of what you're hoping you get in the way of ideas and proposals?
I'd love to see that idea. And we've, On the foundation side, we've actually helped with that for several years. You know, we've been working in this area now. There's the man in overalls. Do you know?
I know
man,
him.
Nathan, yeah. So we found Nathan when
he was
in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
We found Nathan when he was in Tallahassee a couple of years ago, and he moved here. And, you know, he'd be perfect. Nathan, if you're listening, fill out an application and have an idea for the challenge. In Orlando, there's a Fresh Stop mobile bus that actually is a farmer's market on wheels that goes around. And so, like I said, there are so many great ideas out there. And we want to hear from everybody, not just nonprofit partners, but folks who are entrepreneurs and innovators and small business owners about how they can solve that problem. Together is the best. Right? We're going to solve these things together, not in silos.
Yes. And at the same time, Christy, you have partnered up with Feeding Northeast Florida in Jacksonville and other organizations around the state on to work on this issue, correct?
Absolutely. So the challenge is it's going to run all through the summer. So there are regional events and challenge showcases where we're going to bring the best ideas and approaches forward at the regional level. And so the Northeast is one of the regions that we're focusing on. In addition, there's Central Florida, West Florida, and South Florida. And then in mid-September, we'll be running those regional challenges and bringing the best 12 companies or ideas or innovators forward and letting them participate in a statewide challenge so we can identify best-in-class solutions. And there'll be a forum on October 17th on this issue that we're working closely with some of these partners, including Feed in Florida, on. And there'll be folks that are national thought leaders on this topic that we can bring in to help learn from other communities across the country and what they're doing to solve these issues as well.
And as we're talking about the issue of food insecurity in Florida and GuideWell in Florida Blues Block by Block Food Insecurity Challenge, a few more statistics about food insecurity. As we mentioned a few minutes ago, nearly 3 million people in Florida are food insecure. That means they can't consistently access sufficient and nutritious food. Particularly children and seniors are affected. Underemployment, loss of a job, limited transportation options all contribute to food insecurity. And this is a public health issue in Florida. With all of that said, as people have been listening along to this, how can they submit their ideas to be part of the challenge?
Sure. They can go to guidewellinnovation.com. Applications are due by August 15th, so the deadline's coming up pretty quick. And like I said, we will bring forward a panel of experts to look at all the applications and select regional finalists to bring their ideas forward and to compete for regional prize funding of $2,000 for three winners in each of the regions. And then all those 12 entities will get the opportunity to come forward and present at the state level at the fall forum that I've mentioned earlier on October 16th.
Again, that website is guidewellinnovation.com. And Susan, GuideWell and Florida Blue Foundation both partnering up on this.
Yes, we are. So, you know, as our statewide foundation, we're always working with our corporation and wanting to solve those problems, both from a philanthropic standpoint, but also from a business standpoint. So it's a good partnership.
So get those ideas in by mid-August. Again, that website is guidewellinnovation.com. Thanks, ladies, so much to you both. Susan Toler, Vice President of the Florida Blue Foundation, and Kirsty McCool, Executive Director of GuideWell Innovation. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
And in a moment, celebrating the majestic tigers of Jacksonville's own Caddyshack Ranch on International Day of the Tiger. We'll be right back.
WJCT's Summer of Space invites you to experience the thrilling era of the space race all summer long.
enjoy special programming exploring our skies and taking you on a journey through the universe. Featured programs include a new space-themed antiques roadshow, Out of This World, and NOVA's Back to the Moon and the Planets. Visit wjct.org/summer of space to check out all other upcoming Summer of Space programs.
You, humble citizen and taxpayer, the government, a giant faceless bureaucracy.
It seems as though the rich continue to get the breaks and the middle class are just eaten up with all the burden of most of the taxes.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the public advocate at the Internal Revenue Service. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Laura Lippman, author of the popular Tess Monaghan detective series. Her new standalone crime novel, Lady in the Lake, is set in 1960s Baltimore and deals with problems that still face us, like sexism, racism, and homophobia. Lippman also writes personal essays on subjects like becoming a mother at age 51. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The Fed is expected to lower the cost of borrowing this week for the first time since the depths of the financial crisis. That'll please the president, but what about the rest of us? With rates already low, could more easy money tempt some people to take on too much? We'll break down this economic turning point. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Kiss. We love kids, don't we, huh? Yes.
Welcome back. Well, the noise you're listening right now is the sound of a tiger at Caddyshack Ranch. It's called chuffing. Yesterday marked the 9th annual International Day of the Tiger. Caddyshack Ranch here in Jacksonville is marking the event to celebrate these majestic beasts on the verge of extinction. Caddyshack Ranch founder Kurt LaJudas joins us now with more. Good morning.
Thank you for having us here.
Thanks for being here. Let's begin with International Tiger Day. It was actually yesterday.
It was yesterday. We're going to celebrate all week long, but really we celebrate every day.
Of course. Your ranch is known for these incredible beasts, lions, tigers, and other wild beasts. And so why is it important to mark International Tiger Day at Caddyshack Ranch? Educate us.
Awareness is so important. And hopefully as this mass awareness goes out just for this day, hopefully we'll make a huge impact on what our cause is.
And that is to protect tigers, which actually top the endangered species list. Is that correct?
It is, unfortunately, as they say, tigers are dying rapidly, and it's due to human infringement, unfortunately, as we're taking over their habitats.
This is everything from poaching to loss of habitat and even disappearance of their food sources in the wild.
Unfortunately so. We see and hear in these countries where the animals are out in the wild, unfortunately, farmers are taking away tree preservation for farmland. And then later on, as the animals become a nuisance, unfortunately, poisoning or poaching, all these things, unfortunately, are a cause of their demise.
It's interesting to note that just about 10 years ago, there were fewer than 1,500 tigers still living in the wild. Since awareness began to protect them, that number has grown to nearly 4,000. And so tell us about Caddyshack Ranch and your role in protecting these incredible species. You are the largest big cat sanctuary in North Florida. You have nearly 24 rescued Bengal and Siberian tigers.
You know, and what we say, of course, right off is, all the big cats that we have, not one of those were actually taken out of the wild. So they were actually born in captivity at other facilities, sanctuaries, zoos. But what we look at, the animals that come to our facility are part of our education capability of teaching others.
And this weekend, you're encouraging everyone to come out to Caddyshack Ranch, especially kids, to celebrate International Tiger Day. What's on tap?
We open up tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday are days that we're open. But on Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, it's a nighttime event. But all those days, kids can come out, and while supplies last, get a little keepsake of memory, a bracelet of International Tiger Day.
And they'll get to see these animals, too.
A great tour of learning and seeing some beautiful animals.
What do you love about these beasts? What do you love about them?
Their capabilities and majestic moves are just amazing. And as they are actually, I have to say, working together with each other and actually going around and communicating with each other, it's just amazing to watch how they respond.
And is it ever, have you ever had a moment where you've been scared around a tiger?
Oh, good. I thought, good thing you had a tiger.
Do you feel safe working with these animals?
You know, animals are always dangerous. I tell everyone anything with teeth has a capability to bite, and you don't need teeth to do damage. So to respect and to know the capabilities are there are always important.
Always respect the power they have. That's right. And you are the largest big cat sanctuary in the region.
And the oldest.
And the oldest. So this is a great week for people that have never been out to Caddyshack to come out and see what's there.
It's been amazing. And, of course, that's what happens is we're still amazing to come and see all the animals. And people that have lived in Jacksonville, haven't been here, are coming and bringing their friends.
So come on out this weekend, starting Wednesday through Sunday, to the Caddyshack Ranch as they mark all week the International Day of the Tiger. The tiger sits atop the endangered species list. So it's a special focus at Caddyshack. Go to caddyshack.org for more and to get your tickets. And thank you so much. He's the founder of Caddyshack Ranch, Kurt LoJudas. Always good to see you.
Thank you so much. Have fun this weekend. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always want your feedback. Send comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, the latest on the Duval School Board's battle to raise money for school repairs and constructions as the window closed this year. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.